Hey, deserving listeners, this is chapter 4 in our deep dive on the Duggars. Let's get into it. What do you say, Berto?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and I'm also a professor.
My name is Humberto Castañeda and I make grass look green.
So, to start off where we left off last time, we are now at 2004. So, wow. That's the point we are in the timeline. And just to catch you up, in the patron section in chapter 3, we went into the early reports that were being made from Josh and the family about Josh's sexual abusive behavior to 5 younger children, 4 of which were his younger sisters, and another girl was one of the babysitters that were younger than him. And at this point, Josh is in his teen years, and this is before they actually are on television. So let's start off on 2004. So the family knows about the sexual abuse. There's other people that know about it as well. The police, quote unquote, have been notified, although it was one police officer who has a very problem. He's now in prison, by the way, because of multiple counts of child pornography. And the police officer might have also been friends of Jim Bob, right? So maybe went easy on Josh.
There's no indication that this was on purpose. Like, oh, this guy's into this stuff anyway, so let's go to him. However, what a freaking horrible coincidence. And I hypothesize that, for all we know, since it was a family friend, like, it's possible he had something to do with Josh when Josh was younger. Maybe he introduced him to the stuff. Who knows? But in either case, yeah, really bizarre that he goes to this dude to maybe scare Josh out of it, right? Like, put, you know, some cop fear into him. It doesn't work, obviously. And to make matters worse, the guy himself is, like, either already or going to be involved in the same problem.
Yeah. So now, 2004, TLC, the television channel, approached the family to have a special, just a one-off special, one episode special that they would film and publish on their channel. So, Berto, why do you think the family would accept this offer?
So a couple things. The father was already interested in politics and was already trying to, you know, get, I think, their community they were a part of, I think they wanted more prominence. More specifically, I think they wanted to send a message about their religion and a way to live. As to why the family as a whole, well, I don't know. It doesn't sound like most of the family had too much of a say in most of the dealings. Like, certainly when some of the daughters were interviewed in that documentary, they were like, yeah, we had no, my dad did all the negotiating and stuff like that. So, but as far as I can tell and imagine, I think that it was a case of like, hey, this will really help us bring prominence to our movement, to our way of life, our way of thinking.
That's right, exactly. Well, on their blog, along those lines, from their words, I think from the parents' words, they said, "Our desire in opening our home to the world has been to make Christ known and to share Bible principles that are the answers to life's problems!" Exclamation point. "We pray that everyone will find true hope in trusting Jesus Christ!" Exclamation point. So that was their stated reason, which I think is probably their real reason. So the first Duggar family TV special, titled 14 Children and Pregnant Again, and it airs on TLC back when TLC was shifting away from learning and more towards eventually what they are now, which is wall-to-wall new programming in reality television of various different types. And the special was about how such a large family handled chores and parenting. I don't think it went that much into their religion. I think it was more just the spectacle of, like, how is it possible that you manage with 14 children and you're having another child? How does that exactly work?
Yeah, the sense that they indicated why TLC was initially interested was from that angle of, like, it was definitely not like, ooh, and there's this religion. No, it was, how can it physically work, first of all, and then how can you make it work? Yeah.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier about it was kind of like a freak show for many people, but also highly appealing to not only fundamentalist Christians, but also just people looking for more wholesome programming, of which there isn't much of that, even in and especially in reality TV, right? So in the show, they come across like the happiest family in the world. And of course, classic white family, blonde kids, this kind of thing. They come across as very wholesome, very close-knit, obedient, but happy about it, apparently. And none of the problems that are often present in families, like addiction or anger or rebellion or sex, apparently no problems. There were problems, but nothing.
And by the way, we shouldn't, like, you know, we grew up in the 80s, and essentially we were shown families that seemed perfect as well, right? Where the big problem was, like, you looked over your shoulder during that test, or... You hid the sugar from your sister, you know? It was like these kinds of things. And that's, you know, we saw these families on TV. They weren't reality shows, but it was presented as like, hey, these are these perfect little families.
Yeah, I think it's sort of both and, because, of course, there was a lot of that. Your family ties, your different strokes, that kind of thing. The not the Duggars, but the Huxtables.
Well, think of how, in that case... Not only was like it maybe unfair to present like these beautiful, perfect little families, but behind the scenes, you know, the head of this family was a monster.
Yeah, Bill Cosby was raping people who would want to be on the show and were on the show. There are allegations, pretty credible allegations, from actresses who were on the show and would appeal to Bill Cosby to be on the show and also be propelled in their career. And he would take them upstairs, and it was a well-understood thing, not necessarily the raping, but that Bill Cosby was getting together with young women on the casting couch. But on the surface, you had very wholesome storylines. However, it's hard to remember these sorts of things because we haven't watched these shows, but there are famous episodes of Different Strokes and Family Ties where they do go into some pretty hairy areas, some risky areas. Like there was an episode of Different Strokes where the kids are being groomed for child pornography and being abused. And that was family television after dinner at 7 o'clock on NBC or whatever. And they were really going into that. And I remember watching that episode when I was a kid and just being like, what is happening? So they did take risks, you know. I think at the same time, these shows like The Duggars on reality TV, I think it appeals to people because it doesn't have any of those things. You know, people just want to relax. They don't want to necessarily be challenged, which, you know, I can respect.
Yeah, I was going to say that it is a progression, of course, because, you know, back when I was young and I watched The Brady Bunch or The Partridge Family, the conflicts there were even simpler. So you're right that by the 80s, now they're starting to sprinkle in a few more difficult topics. And it's true. My analogy was really more that, like, and I'm not saying it's even wrong. Like, obviously you want to be shown a good, like, hey, aspire to this, right? You don't want to always be shown, here's how horrible and crappy life can be. That's not that inspirational as a kid. So it's nice to say, hey, look at this. Your life could be like this if you follow certain things. That's true. At the same time, there is an unrealistic expectation being set that if you don't balance it, then yeah, you're like, oh, everyone's perfect except me for some reason. And that can be really heartbreaking for one's own self-esteem.
Right. No family is perfect. All families have problems. And these shows absolutely give the impression, you hear from lots of people, that they would watch these shows and think, wow, my family is broken compared to these television families. And I would say 95% of people think that, because no families or very few families share their problems that they're having. So everyone is in the norm in that their family is going through difficulties, but they think they're in the minority and there's something deeply shameful about what they're going through. So now it's not NBC's responsibility to somehow correct for that. It's sure. Other people's responsibility. But anyway, so they get their first special. So I think it'd be worth actually going a little bit into the how the family is structured, because parentification is a thing. So,
oh, because what?
Parentification.
Parentification. Oh, the thing where kids start having to act as parents.
Right, or they're just elevated. Okay. They're elevated too high in the hierarchy given their age.
Okay.
But, and we'll get into more of this later when we get into the religious section, which might be a number of chapters from now, given my notes. But just briefly, which is depicted in the special here and throughout the series that they eventually get, the father is in absolute authority. And then it's the mother, and the mother, Michelle, is completely happy, apparently, with being subservient to her husband. She's doting. Whenever Jim Bob is talking, Michelle is just like staring at him. That can't be real. You know, she sees him behind closed doors. You know, when you first start dating someone, maybe there's that glowing look that you have towards your partner, but especially after 14 children, you just gotta figure that it's not all glowing. So she had a pretty good face that she would put on. I think you were saying that it would creep you out when you would watch it.
And look, you're probably right. I'm unsure how much she really like believed and ingested all of it, but in either case, I did get an uneasy feeling because of what you're saying was he would talk, and yeah, there's so many times where they would show and she's just looking up as if he's holy. And I was like, that creeped me out for a couple reasons. One, the hierarchy they established, that was no accident. That was on purpose, right? It was all hierarchy based on men first. Two, it did mean, in the context of what I'm watching, that she's probably not there to protect that much because she's there to like listen and be quiet and be subservient. So I don't know, like that whole aspect gives me the heebie-jeebies.
She's not there to protect the children?
Kids. Yeah, in the sense that like when your main concern is following the law that I've been given and I have to look up, never will I look like peers, I will always look up here. I feel like in the process, plus you have like so many kids, you're probably not going to be paying as much attention to the needs of the kids. Maybe I'm exaggerating that point, but it just seems like the biggest important part of that situation wasn't so much like one of the little kids might need, but it's really like, are we following the laws here? And am I listening to the one above me? And the one above me right now is my husband.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I think another angle to that is that you're trained from, you know, and she wasn't raised in this model, but by the time you have 14 kids, yeah, I think it'd been 20 years at this point.
Right.
She has this very deeply ingrained paradigm of I don't think for myself, right? So I don't necessarily think of myself as someone that is responsible for monitoring the kid's safety or thinking about the child welfare because I have been trained and I've been training myself to constantly defer to my husband. So until he tells me to do something about it, then maybe I don't. I don't know. I mean, maybe Michelle had a lot of self-directed behavior behind the scenes, but it certainly doesn't look that way when she's in his presence, you know?
And it seems to me like the hierarchy goes beyond just the dad in that males in the family also get preference. I don't know if to the mom, but certainly within their siblings.
Yeah, well, the explicit hierarchy is that the kids, regardless of gender, are under the parents. So there's not the explicit that it's not explicit that the mother is below Josh, that sort of thing. But anyway, so you have the father, absolute authority, then you have the mother, and then you have the children that are underneath that by age. And another structure that we should mention is that they have the buddy system. And I don't know if this is inherently to their cult religion, but it was a big part and a focus of the various different TV episodes that they made. And the way that did you see the buddy system? Did you see how did you run into that?
I heard about it. I guess I didn't catch enough about how it worked.
So wait till you hear this. As soon as the baby is weaned, often with another baby being born, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then that weaned baby, a very, very small child,
yeah,
it is given to an older sibling. So that's the buddy system. You know, when you hear buddy system, you think
more close in age or something.
Yeah, you think like a 10-year-old who looks after a 7-year-old. Yeah. No. This is, and it's always the girls, it's always the sisters, the daughters, that are literally just handed the next child in line. And sometimes the older sister would be pretty young. I'm guessing, I don't know the exact configuration, but I'm guessing that some of the big sisters, basically the moms that are taking care, are like 7 years old, maybe 10, I don't know, but really young. And then the boys were supposed to do outdoor work, and did a lot of outdoor work, because the cult actually has a lot of child labor that we would, not only in the home, but also
they built a lot of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Not only for the cult religion, but also other parishioners in the church. A guy would have a business that would say like, well, you know, I have a construction business, just completely separate from the cult. And right. He would recruit children from the congregation, because it was a mandate that children learn how to do hard work, you know, and it benefits this business owner because you literally have free labor.
I mean, it's one thing if it's like there's a rotation and it helps the kids because they learn some stuff, but it does feel like, I don't know if they presented it this way incorrectly, but it does feel like it was an abused part of the religion. Like they overused it.
Well, when you have no checks and balances, then at the very least, you're going to have bad actors who are going to take it too far, you know? And there were many accounts of not only these, non-sanctioned parishioners in employing children, but also the cult organization themselves taking children and say, you know, you've been tapped to come to headquarters. And the kids would be like, oh my God. And then they'd go to headquarters and they'd spend 12 hours a day hauling bricks to build a new facility. And yeah, if it was a half an hour here and there to build character, so to speak, maybe weed the bushes or something as a team, and then you have, you know, this learned lesson after. No, from the accounts and from the videos that we saw in the documentary, right. The kids, it looks like we're looking at another country in which there are no child labor laws. The kids have like work gloves and they have wheelbarrows. You know, we're talking like 7-year-old, 10-year-old kids who are
hammering
nails into stuff. You know, they probably have like a really deep voice by now. It's just like, yeah, it's Miller time or whatever. Anyway, so the buddy system is, as soon, you know, maybe the kid is 18 months, 24 months, right? Boom, they're just given to one of the older siblings, and the older sibling is now completely in charge. And there is a really horrific scene on the show years later where one of the infants has a seizure disorder of some sort and a lot of other health problems. And while the cameras are shooting, did you see this?
Yeah.
Yeah, while the cameras are shooting, one of this younger girl, I think she's 5 years old or something, has a pretty significant seizure that lasts for a while. And the buddy, the surrogate mother, which is this, I think, 15-year-old sister.
Yeah, she didn't look that old.
is suddenly just like, oh my God, what do I do? And
well, and at the very least, like maybe leave some instructions for that child. I don't know.
And who knows if that was provided, but it was a stark example of how these children were left alone to parent these younger children. And then you just think about all of, you know, you have daughters. Imagine if your daughters were kind of free range the way that the Duggars were. And then imagine all the situations that arise throughout the day. And these kids are homeschooled as well. So it's 24/7 that you would have like a 10-year-old sister that's responsible for a young child that wants to run around or wants to get into things or fights with their next in line sibling or won't do their homework, or, you know, just think about all the annoyances and it's hard enough for adults to do it. Imagine a child doing this.
Dude, I was going to say that. Like, first of all, so I have 12 and 7, right? That there's their ages. It's almost every weekend, let alone during the summer, well, I'll find, normally it's like the seven-year-old doing something either dangerous or destructive, or but she doesn't mean to be, and I'll be like, what are you doing? And then I'll call on the 12-year-old, like, why didn't you, it's like, either I told her not to, or I don't know, or I was, it's always like that. And the other thing, my 12-year-old went for the first time this summer, went to a camp. It was a week-long camp. And I was terrified to send her because, you know, I just the idea, like, my little baby's not here. But I thought, you know, it'll be fine and stuff. Well, it was fun and all this, but there was a cabin bully that they had to kick out of the camp.
Right, you told me about this.
That was affecting her directly. And it's like, that's her first outing. So like, this is what happens when you have well, in this case, they were supervised, but you know, at a camp, there's less supervision, there's strangers and stuff, and there's lots of kids together. And there's a reason why Lord of the Flies was Lord of the Flies. Like things, kids are not structured, well thought out, you know, functioning adult humans. They are not. And so you put kids in charge of kids, yeah, of course, chaos and bad things might happen.
Right. So let's talk about parentification. This is a concept in family therapy that we have been talking about for decades. And it's a pretty complicated concept, but generally speaking, it is the parentifying of a child. Now, the child might be a peer to the parents, or might even be parent to the parents, or they're just elevated way too high. They might not be parent level like the Duggar kids, but they have parent-like responsibilities. So the problem is when you socialize or force or continually reward a child for taking care of their younger siblings, the child, the older child, ends up running into a dilemma where they want love. They also don't want to be punished. They want attention. They want to feel competent, right? They want, it's like, ooh, you know, I'm given a big girl responsibility. So they are at a dilemma and they have to give up childhood. They have to give up their needs, right, as well. Because when you're 10, 12 years old, you have a lot of childish, selfish needs. And when those emerge for the child, they run into that dilemma of, well, if I express this, I might get punished or abused. But at the very least, I might lose the love and attention that I very much get when I actually suppress my feelings and my needs and I rise to the occasion to take care of my younger sibling or whatever the parentification, you know, process is happening. And so the problem is that from the outside, and maybe even from the inside of the parents, it'll look like the parentified child is capable and is enjoying it. In fact, by after a while, if you try to take away the parentification role from the child, even if it's a little bit, and I would say almost every family goes through this with multiple children. You know, the older siblings will feel somewhat responsible for their younger siblings. And that has to be navigated very carefully. And even if you do that pretty well, the older sibling, sometimes you need to have a conversation with that older child. Say, like, it's great that you care about your younger sibling and keeping her on track, but understand you're not her mom. You know, I'm her parent and you do not have that much authority. One, don't worry about it. But two, you're really coming down hard on your younger sibling, and that's just not okay. So knock it off, kind of a thing. But also, for your sake, you should be allowed to just be a kid. So, you know, don't worry about that. But, it, you know, when it's more pathological than that, then you have children that look like they love it and like they're very mature. Like one of the big red flags for parentification is when I meet a child and think that they're 3, 4, 5, 6 years older than they actually are. They talk in a very mature way. It's not a slam dunk indication, but it is a red flag for that, particularly if they seem to have an understanding of responsibility and even when they have a really in-depth understanding of adult feelings. Like as a therapist, when I would have say, a 10-year-old that seemed to empathize with me a lot, I would find later that they learned that because they had to be that way because the parents were socializing them to be that way. And empathy is good, but, you know, the normal course of development, maturity, and empathy is a 10-year-old shouldn't need that much awareness of adult feelings or really anyone else's feelings because they're very selfish and they're, which is good. You know, it's a good thing that they're selfish and self-centered and they should be allowed to really stew in their own development and focus on that. So it's another major red flag. So it's hard to detect this because the truly parentified children will seem like the most perfect children. They'll be very good in class because, you know, they're terrified all the time of disappointing the teacher. They will be helpful to the other kids. They'll seem very mature. They'll have a lot of empathy for adults. And it's this, you know, hidden massive amounts of abuse that's happening to the child. So what happens for these individuals is they suppress their hurt feelings, they suppress their childhood, they suppress their anger, they don't have a connection with the self potentially because they were never allowed that even when they were younger. They have a very conflicted feeling between selfishness and selflessness. You know, one of the major things in therapy with folks like this is really wrestling with their schemas and distortions around, is it okay for me to focus on myself? Is it okay for me to get what I want? I mean, these kinds of questions for people like you and me, Berto, who weren't raised in a parentified manner, it's obvious. It's like, yeah, of course, you know, within reason. But yeah, of course, you know, I if I want something, I deserve to at least entertain the idea of getting it. Do you know what I mean? But these people,
that's crazy.
Yeah. It's just completely off the table. And you can imagine that these people are thus very angry about that. Not only was that imposed on them, but they actually are doing it to themselves. So they're continually just massively angry and just building up this anger. And a big part of the therapy is actually getting them to express that anger. These individuals are very prone to becoming codependent or overfunctioning for an underfunctioner because of obvious reasons. They need to take care of an underfunctioner in order to feel like they're worthy or even just safe. That, you know, they could literally, given the context of the socialization to be parentified, they might literally have tremendous anxiety if they're not taking care of somebody, if they're not in that role of overfunctioning. Also, there's a massive conflict internally between freedom and responsibility, right? Because they've been over responsible and they haven't been able to exert their freedom at all. And so they might, not only internally, but they might externally. So parentified parents, overfunctioning parents can continue the problem, right? You would think they wouldn't because they went through it. But sometimes when they have a 10-year-old, you know, say you're a parentified parent, you have a 10-year-old daughter, and the 10-year-old daughter is starting to express a selfish, normal selfishness and normal freedom, a desire for freedom. And for you, given all the internalized voices and the conflict you have inside of yourself about these, because like by the time you're an adult, people on the outside aren't necessarily the ones telling you you have to be this way. It's all internalized. So you're the one berating yourself. And so the 10-year-old is starting to act normal. And you start to come down on the 10-year-old because you, in your heart, you think that that is too selfish and too free, too chaotic, too risky. And, you know, also there's a bit of, well, when I was 10, I was taking care of three of my younger siblings and you're only taking care of one. So suck it up, kid. You know, there's the normal range of what a child should be going through has been askew. And so so it's like, well, I know things weren't great for me as a child, and for my daughter, things are better. But they don't realize they're still kind of in that zone of parentifying their children. So these individuals go through a lot of troubles in life. They have to find themselves. They have to express their anger. They have to extract themselves from overfunctioning, underfunctioning relationships. They have to learn how to not be attracted to underfunctioners as partners. They have to learn how to be selfish. They have to learn how to be assertive. One of the phrases I often hear from these folks is they will assert themselves, you know, after years of therapy, they'll finally start to assert themselves and then they'll report to me and they'll be like, I really feel like I'm being mean. that phrase, you know, I really feel like I'm being really mean to people. And when I hear them tell the story of it, I'm like, that's not mean.
That's You're not mean.
If anything, you have a long way to go to be fair to yourself, but at least you're kind of asserting yourself and your needs and your worth. And so there's, you know, it's that internal voice of like, there is something deeply wrong with you if you assert yourself. So the kids in this family of the Duggar family, it's a breeding ground for that kind of psychology, right? And personality. Usually in families, you have, you know, 3-4 kids. So, you know, the amount of kids who can be parentified are, you know, maybe 2 or something. In this family, You could literally have all the girls and the boys too, maybe because they're put to work early, being parentified in this way. And so by the time all of these allegations start to come out and they start getting interviewed on Megyn Kelly, which we'll get to in a second, there's no ability for the children to check in with themselves and say, how do I feel about this? Because they've never been allowed to ask that question to begin with, because right from the get-go, they're responsible. That the love and attention that they get is completely dependent on how good of a parent they are at the age of 7 years old. It's really awful. It's really awful. But first, Berto, actually, let's take a little break. What do you say?
Let's do it. You know, as you were describing all this, I was obviously not parentified in these ways, because I didn't live with siblings. My brother lived in the States, and so I didn't live with him until I was older. And once I did, I was certainly not parentified with him and stuff like that. However, a couple of interesting things came to mind, because when I was living in New York and I was 5, there were some things, you know, you were describing how sometimes you'll meet with kids and they seem like they're a couple of years older or something. I have these stories that my aunt tells me about me at 5 in New York, and where I would take her and I would like be like, I know the shortcuts. I know how to get, like, I seemed very like independent. Like, I know how to get around. And there were these times where, for example, I've told this one before, where my dad dropped me off where I was supposed to be being watched until it was school time, but he was late to a big meeting or something, so they weren't answering the door, but he just left me there. And then they weren't there. And I had to walk myself to school at 5, you know, like in New York City. And so when I think of that, I'm like, I think my dad was, you know, single parent doing postgraduate stuff. So really, really busy trying to raise me. I think there were some aspects where I had to self-parentify or something. And then later when I was in Colombia, the other thing that came to mind was since my dad unfortunately started, you know, not working when I was, I guess, 11 and having problems and really struggling in life, I feel like there were some aspects where I had to try to parent him a little bit. I was unsuccessful entirely. But so yeah, and because then when you were talking about some of the struggles, I've certainly had some of those struggles where I haven't been able to draw boundaries for myself that easily sometimes, or, you know, not, I'd like bend over backwards sometimes when I shouldn't, or not be able to say no when I, and I wonder if some of that stems from that, like, oh, I can't deal with my feelings right now because, you know, someone's got to be responsible here.
You absolutely were parentified. And I'm glad you bring this up, because many of the listeners might relate to what I was saying, but they weren't in a cult family like this where they were made to take care of the younger children. Your parentification didn't come from taking care of a younger sibling. Your parentification came from the fact that your dad, he treated you like you were an adult a lot, which can be a good thing, right? To try to help a child to mature in terms of intelligence or rhetoric and this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing from an early age, emotionally, your dad wasn't the most protective of your childhood and your fragility as a young person, you know? But at the very least, at some point when you're 11 and his life started to take a downturn, you were, in some emotional instances, his father. You could see his problems, and you had to manage him in ways that you shouldn't have had to as a child of his, you know? So at the very least, you were parentified during then, but I'm guessing that parentification began earlier. And yeah, your major, the crux of your therapy throughout your adult life has been focusing on you,
Yeah.
And focusing on your body and your emotions and this kind. And for you, the dilemma between freedom and responsibility, you could argue, has been a major conflict in your psyche and in your behavior throughout your adult life, not so much more recently, but in the past, you know, with the spending or with your marital issues where you're, you know, you have all these urges to maybe, you could argue, want to be a kid. You know, it's like, I don't want to have the kinds of responsibilities that I have as an adult. And I was never given a chance to just be a kid. And that's the theme that you'll hear from parentified people is they really were just never allowed to just. So a big part of my therapy with them is to frame it this way, because it can be kind of alarming. Some people will feel like, I feel like I'm having urges and thoughts like a 13-year-old would. And I'm 45. What's wrong with me? And it's like, it's totally normal. Of course, you know, let's monitor it, but let's go with it in a way that is controlled and healthy for you to actually get those needs met. Because, you know, there's a reason why 13-year-olds are the way that they often are. There's a developmental reason for it. They need to go through those steps of, I am who I am, and I'm very insecure about who I am, but I don't want to admit that. And so I'm just going to assume that I'm awesome and my parents are idiots, because that feels good to me, and I can't really handle nuance at this point. And so I am going to find myself and maybe even find things that I know are going to piss off my parents, because at least that's a stark way of identifying that this is me and not my parents, you know. It doesn't always necessarily go down that way, but there's a reason why kids go through, you know, the terrible twos, the terrible fours. There's reasons why kids go through those and different versions of it. It's because these are tests. These are a playground for the child to play around with who I am, and is it okay for me to not be my parents? And through that process, and you have parents that are there caring and holding it, the parents don't necessarily say yes to everything, right?
Right.
But they don't punish it out of a child. They don't eliminate the opportunity for the child to play in that playground. And then with enough time, then the child graduates to a more nuanced point of view of, yes, I do matter. And yes, my feelings are important. And there are other people in the world besides me that I have to think about. Without going through that phase, you never graduate. You only do things for other people's benefit because you feel like you have to. You're rarely doing it because you just want to from inside of your heart. You're terrified if you don't do it. And from the outside, it'll look like this person is very selfless and very caring, but there's a chance that they're only that way because of fear. It's a fear-based altruism. It's a fear-based giving, which is, you know, a recipe for disaster, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I would say you absolutely were parentified.
Yeah, just to some extent. And you know, the thing with you were mentioning of being a kid and not knowing how much to be selfish, how much to be selfless. That's definitely been a theme. And so I think a lot of times I have treated myself to things because, gosh darn it, I deserve it. But it sometimes overcompensating, being like, gosh darn it, I deserve everything because I didn't get a lot. And so, right. And
you recently bought a Porsche. And you could argue that was part of it. You know, your conflict between freedom and responsibility throughout your life has created a lot of strife, sometimes compulsive spending or hurtful behavior to others in your life. And you've been really working on it in therapy and with your relationships. And you've reached a point in your late 40s where you have an impulse, say, you know, I don't know what age we want to put to it, but it's certainly reminiscent of your teenage life. And you even said that the contact you had with your childhood friend that from Columbia that you would often talk about cars, you know, reconnected you with those feelings. And then you revisit them now and you're thinking, well, 10 years ago, I would have either acted on it in this really horrible way, like I would have bought the expensive Porsche and went into debt tremendously, or I would have shut the whole thing down because I would have identified it as this too much responsibility. But now I'm at a point, you know, if I might talk from your mind, that I actually feel like I can navigate these things better and can evaluate these things. You know, the freedom to buy this pointless object, this Porsche, has always been a dream of mine. And it would be this gift for myself, you know, this selfish gift that I want that would satisfy the teenage version of me that I was never really able to satisfy because of all the ups and downs of this whole story. You know what I mean?
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think what it was is a matter of extremes in either direction. Like with some things, I overcompensated. And with some things, I completely shut down. Or at least for example, I really never felt like I deserved or should be allowed to buy a special car, like something that I really loved. Like, oh, that's wrong. Like, whereas with clothes, I'm like, yeah, I need to go and prove to the world that I need to own the most expensive clothing in the world. And so, yeah, it's like extremes in either direction. And with this is more like, all right, well, okay, I'm gonna buy a car toy, but in my terms, like something that I can feel good about and blah, blah, blah. And so it's a more balanced approach, I guess.
I mean, it still wasn't entirely balanced because if you had been entirely balanced, you would have given it a little bit more time, I think, and also informed your wife about your thinking process.
True. The weird thing is, like, I think if something hadn't awakened this, which was definitely this experience with having my friend here and stuff like that, I just don't think, and, you know, on the one hand, I would have saved some money. On the other hand, I've been really happy with my car. So it's like, I don't know. It's one of these weird things where I don't know if this hadn't happened and triggered it, if I would have even, because obviously the best way to do it is like, there's this thing I really want. Okay, I'm going to plan for it. I'm going to set a plan. I'm going to say,
No. Right? It could have literally been the same day, but you, in your heart, I think, because it's logical that you would have, at the very least, revealed to your wife that, by the way, today I'm buying a Porsche.
Oh, she knew. I mean, she knew we were going to go look at it. She wasn't, she just, A, wasn't thinking I was actually going to buy it. And B, since she has no concept of prices and things, she thought the thing was like almost three times as much as what it was.
Well, that's my point, is fact that she was not told. So you could have, the timeline could have been exactly the same, but because of your inner shame of, I don't deserve things.
Right, sure, yeah.
Then you don't say. In fact, you know, you were telling me that you were afraid that I was going to judge you.
Right.
It's possible that at the core of it was this, of just this childhood experience that you went through, either explicitly or implicitly, having freedom and enacting on that freedom and that selfishness was terribly in, you know, you got a lot of messages that there was something deeply wrong with you if you did those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, I've told this story before that I can count on one hand, less than all five fingers, the times I got into deep trouble with my dad. And one of them was because on the way home from school, I was really little, like, I don't know, second grade or something. Someone was selling a Michael Jackson poster and I bought it. And when I got home, I was terrified to tell my dad that I had bought a poster. So instead I lied and I told him I won it in a spelling bee. And then of course he caught me in the lie because I couldn't keep it straight. And then I got in trouble for that. But like, why would I? And that's totally it. Like, I'm not allowed to just spend my money on a poster. That's, I don't deserve that.
So this is how the pathology perpetuates itself, even when you're a child, because the way you enact your freedom is pathological and almost forces people to come down on you about it.
Right.
Because you ended up lying to your dad. If you had just told him, or, hey, Dad, I saw this poster, I'm going to buy it, and I don't care what you say, because I really want this poster.
Well, of course, I'm a little kid, so I'm like, I don't...
Your dad probably would have been like, well, okay, you know, whatever.
I certainly got in trouble not for the poster. I got in trouble for lying about it.
Right. So that's the pathology of it, is that because you're still busted up on the inside, you avoid telling him, and thus push him into a position where he has to discipline you for the entire ball of wax. And so you walk away with yet another example and experience where
right?
You screwed things up, and thus you shouldn't be taking freedoms about this sort of thing. And then that, you know, continues to grow until you have this compulsive spending thing.
Dude, I think we've uncovered this whole other side of my coin, because, you know, for years the struggle was mainly with the over excess, right? The darn it, I never had and now I can and I deserve, so I'm going to go crazy and prove to the world that I'm worthy, right? And in the meantime, and you know, like we've talked about before, I've addressed a lot of that. But in the meantime, there was the other side of the coin, which was, well, how to handle it when I can or are, should be able to, or, you know, deserve something, whatever. How to handle that? Because apparently there's still hurt there.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible that the compulsion is mostly based on what we're talking about right now. I mean, yeah. Maybe you call it parentification, maybe you call it something else, the denial of your feelings and the disallowance of you being able to be selfish like a normal child would be, you know?
Well, that money couldn't be spent, because like money at one point became a thing that if there's any money, it has to go to my dad and it's going to go into a black hole. We'll never see it again. So for me to spend money is like, what are you talking about? That's crazy talk.
Yeah. A lot of kids will go through that kind of experience, but I imagine only some develop this kind of complex between spending that lasts a lifetime, you know?
Yeah.
You could imagine that there would be always a little bit of that. It's like any kid that emerges out of poverty and makes their own career like you did has a bit of an issue or some kind of path regarding like spending and that sort of.
Well, but not just the poverty, but the fact that there was this conduit, like whenever I had cash or anyone had cash, it would go to my dad because he needed it for mysterious needs, and then the money would just be gone. But you yourself couldn't spend the money.
Right. Right. And so to me, in terms of how I weigh these things out, that emotional side of things for you, I think, was probably more foundational to this problem of the denial of you being allowed to be a kid and being selfish and having freedoms, you know what I mean? That are normal, and that conflict internally results. So the reason why I really want to emphasize this is because when one is a parentified and an overfunctioner, then you become your own monster, because unless you are aware of it and you start to heal from it in therapy, then you perpetuate the problems even if you don't have kids. You know, like a common example would be that you, as an overfunctioner, having been abused growing up emotionally in this way, parentified, and you are very attracted to people who are very underfunctioning, maybe people suffering from addiction or depression or shady behavior or something like this, irresponsibility, immaturity. And you end up engaging in a relationship with that person, and you end up being very controlling of them or over-concerned. You know, there's basically two the different styles of codependency that I identified in my work are the accommodating codependent, the controlling codependent, and the chameleon codependent, which is not a common, the third one, but usually they're either accommodating or they're controlling. So anyway, and the dynamic is created by you. You end up pushing someone who might be kind of underfunctioning to be more and more underfunctioning, which gives you more and more reason to be overfunctioning and overly concerned. And so that's my point, is like it works against you, and it is tragic in that way. You know, trauma and parentification is, jokingly I say, is the gift that keeps on giving, because you go through the difficulty and then it just sticks with you and continues to perpetuate the problem and compounds it, you know?
It's just a new dimension that I find interesting, that I want to dive a little more into myself, because if we had a conversation about the spending and stuff, I would have said, yeah, well, I used to have a lot of problems with that, and I'm much better now. But I didn't catch on to this other side of it, which is the guilt of spending correctly or spending when it's okay or whatever. And because I didn't have this dimension of parentification, I hadn't even thought of that. And again, obviously, I'm not in the same boat. I didn't have to raise 20 kids by myself or any of that. But interesting, some of these aspects I feel like I can slightly relate to.
Yeah. So, okay. So, Berto, the rest of this episode is just going to be for patrons of the podcast. We're going to continue with this discussion, but it's just going to be for patrons because we want to reward the patrons for becoming patrons. So, for the rest of you, if you're not a patron and you want to hear the rest of this, become a patron, go to patreon.com. And if not, everyone in that category, please take care of yourself, because
you deserve it.
So the pathway forward for you and others is to really evaluate the kinds of automatic thoughts that you have regarding freedom, responsibility, and selflessness and selfishness. Like I was saying earlier, how so many clients would have this automatic thought, this schema that they're being mean when they're being assertive. For you, Berto, the fulcrum point would be that moment where you really want to buy the Porsche and you don't necessarily know if you're going to get it. And at what point was there a pretty natural moment to inform your wife of your intentions and you didn't? You know,
yeah.
What was the fear there? Because it was not justified. It was not real. You made that up. And when you do that, you know, and God bless your wife for adjusting, but she could have not adjusted. She could have, you know, it would be completely within normal spousal feelings and behavior to be like, you're going to take that thing back because you can't do shit like that. You can't spend our money unilaterally, you know what I mean? So she didn't do that, but you risked that. And imagine if she had done that and how that would have created a whole other a swirl of difficulty regarding freedom and responsibility, you know? There's a way to be free and to have your needs met, because this is part of that. It's not just a thing. It's a very important emotional thing for you, which I appreciate. And you don't want to sabotage your pathway for that by not really focusing on those fears that get enacted in the moment. And I'm guessing those fears aren't just when you're buying Porsches, I'm guessing.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and like, what's weird about it is like, there wasn't even a moment where I thought, oh, I should call. Like, that didn't even happen. So it's such a blind spot. It's like,
well, another way of putting it is subconsciously it did, and subconsciously.
Well, obviously. I'm just saying, like, there was no moment where I thought, I should call my wife. That didn't happen. But I'm sure the reason is because underneath the hood, my brain was going like, well, I don't deserve this. I should never, this is not something I should ever award myself with. Therefore, I should definitely not check with anyone, because anyone who challenges me on it is going to be both right and wrong, and this is going to ruin everything. Like, you know, it's like all these little micro things go behind the scenes, but the net on my net awareness is like not awareness, which is, again, it's like the opposite side of this coin of like, I have this blind side of like, well, wait a minute, what about when it is something that I actually do want to buy, but then I feel guilty and I don't feel like I need to, I can talk to people, and it's weird.
Yeah. And yeah, those feelings are deep, you know, the shame and the guilt and the fear is real and patterned from a lifetime of that, you know, because it's not just when you were a child, but then you did it a lot to yourself through setting up situations like that in your adult life.
Yeah,
you know,
right?
Like that, you tell that one story how you invited a bunch of work friends to dinner.
Yeah, not dinner. It was my birthday,
and you paid for everything. It was like a couple dozen people or something.
Yeah, it was a lot of people. It cost me a lot of money.
And a friend of yours was like, "What are you doing? Why did you buy everyone's, that's a lot of money?" And it was this stark example of this wake-up call of just like, yeah, what am I doing, you know? And those kinds of moments give you an opportunity to think like, what's going on in my mind that causes this to happen, you know? Because so often when we think of these kinds of patterns or these kinds of traumas, we think about the, you know, getting angry at our parents for putting us through this, but that's fine. But a lot of the work has to do with wrestling with yourself, you know, wrestling with these assumptions that you have. And that part of the self is there for a reason and is not happy when you confront it or even call it out. You know, it's like an addiction. It's like, don't look at me because you need me. If you look at me, then you might get rid of me, and I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that that doesn't happen. And so the real work is there. You know, it's one thing when I'm talking with clients about this, you know, like just to put it into some concrete terms, I might work with a client, say, for 6 months before I introduce and know that the concept of parentification is worth talking about. And then I introduce it, and it might, let's say it takes a couple months for the client to fully comprehend what I'm talking about. Well, then you've got like 10 years of therapy while you wrestle with yourself. You know? know, just knowing about this is just the beginning. So much of it is these, you know, it ends up kind of being like, I'm fighting against the client sometimes, you know, to be like, you're not being mean. You're asserting your needs. You know, I'm advocating for them, but their most dominant voice towards me is opposition to what I'm trying to do for them, you know? And it takes a lot of work to reorient the person. Anyway, so to conclude, the family structure, again, father, absolute authority, then mother, then the kids. Then you have that buddy system. And I don't know if any of the kids were parentified. It'd be hard to imagine that they weren't. And then you have this other aspect to the family structure, that dating is forbidden. And really, outside people are not allowed in the system, you know. A regular family system has other people involved. You have, and they did have one extended family member, that cousin, that, you know, heathen cousin would occasionally come in. She was in the documentary, which I was surprised by, actually, that they allowed this secular
negative influence. Yeah.
Yeah. And she was a regular girl who talked about Bieber and whatever, you know, whatever she was talking about, and wore jeans and this sort of thing. And so it shows that the family wasn't as rigid as I think maybe people imagine that they'd be, or they didn't need to be, because the control over the children was so absolute. I don't know. So there's that. And then the dating is forbidden part is a part of that insular format, not only for this family, but also for this cult that they're in. And they would court, and it would be chaperoned.
With the intention of marriage. Like, there was no like, oh yeah, I'll go on some dates and stuff. No, no, no. If you're going to court with the intention of marriage, that's one thing. That's the only thing. Yeah.
And so, of course, the other person would have to be on board, and their family would have to be on board, because, you know, if you just were at a regular high school and Josh were to date someone randomly, the other person would be like, what? No, yeah. I'm not doing that. And the other family might even say like, what? No, you're not dating that freak, you know? So they would have to definitely date within their cult. And also, it's probably an arranged situation, right? The parents are so heavily involved that they might have been the ones to get the ball rolling to begin with. Who knows?
Right. At least it seemed that way, especially for the girls, for the women, right? Like, in one of those other documentaries another YouTube with two dudes that were from that cult, they were talking about how no matter how bad it got for them, they were still guys. And so it was never as bad as it would be for the women. They had such little say, such little participation. But yeah, I get the sense that like pretty much the parents called the shots when it came to the whole thing, except that maybe the guys got more say on yay or nay. I don't know.
Yeah, the systematic stripping of power for girls and women was severe. Not only in this way they're talking about, but also forcing them to take care of their younger siblings. So much was at stake, you know.
Yeah.
Say you have a 13-year-old that wants to be a normal 13-year-old, and they don't want to do their chores, which in this family would be not taking care of their younger sibling. Your younger sibling could literally die. And there's not a lot of 13-year-olds that are willing to risk that, right? If they fully understand, which of course they would, that that's what's at stake. So, and that's just the parenting thing. Of course, the dress, and then blaming girls for lust that men might feel for them. You know, the way you're dressing is, what they call it? Like I something.
Oh, right. What was it?
I temptation or.
Well, because they had a thing where, first of all, I remember a few things. One was the Nike, that they would call out Nike whenever someone.
What was that? What is that Nike thing?
So anytime there was a woman in view or walking around that was dressed in a provocative way, the women would call out, Nike, Nike. And that would let the men know to avert their eyes and not be tempted, right? That was one thing. And then there was this other thing, which was...
But why Nike? What's Nike?
They didn't explain why Nike. That they were just, that's what they would call. The other thing they talked about was this idea of defrauding. Remember this? Defrauding. Those guys that I watched the YouTube thing were also talking about this. They had this concept of defrauding, that if you looked attractive, you were essentially defrauding the other person by promising something you can't and should not deliver.
Right.
Right. So it was this kind of weird thing.
Yeah. And that was never placed on boys. That was never.
No. It was like, you're different. Yeah. And then, it's all and your then, fault. Yeah, the eye, I can't remember the term, but it was like eye.
Yeah. Something. Yeah. Maybe I'll come across it in my notes. Yeah. I did a search by eye. It must not involve that word. But anyway, then another aspect is denying the opportunity for divorce. I mean, there's a reason why, as our society becomes, especially in the past when it became more, a little bit more equal for women, there's a reason why a lot of women started to divorce. That why there was a reason why in heterosexual relationships, most of the divorces were initiated by women. It's because women, on average, are denied their feelings, are oppressed, are abused. You know, of course, men can be abused in heterosexual relationships, but when you have a system of sexism, then you're going to see an effect like this. And as you start to release that, those sexist systems, at the very least, you're going to see women start to say, okay, finally, I can get out of this thing. And in a system like this cult, you can imagine there's a lot of women that are not happy in their situation.
Yeah.
And it is completely forbidden that you get divorced, right?
Yeah, of course.
So that's another system of control, not only of the members, but also particularly of the women and the girls. And then, of course, keeping them pregnant constantly keeps them in a constant state of dependence on their husbands, not only practically, but also financially. It's hard to have a career when you're pregnant pretty much constantly. You know what I mean? Either recovering from a pregnancy. You know, it's hard to get a career going in that situation.
Something that came to mind for me when I was watching it, the documentary, and just think about this whole thing, is that they're trying to use systems that actually were useful to humans at some point, even though it was unfair. It was never fair, and it was always oppressive. But it's like when you have famines and diseases that run rampant and people just die so easily and everything, the idea of like, look, you got to go have as many kids as possible. You certainly cannot, quote, divorce. Like, you can't break up the family. What are you going to do? Go wander the desert? Like, no. These families are precious because like humans can go extinct at any minute. You know. But now we're trying to apply these things in the 21st century. And it like clashes against so many things. And unfortunately, it strips away so many rights from the participants, especially the women.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Berto, let's adjourn there. Next time we'll pick up on my timeline here. We'll get all the way to 2005 next time, Berto.
Wow.
And everyone out there, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.